with the leaders of the Russian NKVD and with British spymaster William Stevenson. It was with British help that Donovan undertook what was known as Operation Jedburgh, in which teams of British, French, and American commandos parachuted into Nazi-occupied Europe and conducted the espionage that laid the groundwork for D-Day. The men selected to be Jedburghs were trained in firearm sabotage and close-quarters fighting. In early 1945, while staying at Claridge's, his favorite London hotel, Donovan met with a Jedburgh soldier named Douglas Bazzata. The 34-year-old Bazzata was a red-haired former U.S. Marine with a fondness for tweaking authority by calling colonels Sugar rather than Sir. He was also a top marksman and was once the unofficial heavyweight boxing champion of the Marine Corps. As he sat down for lunch, Bazzata was curious. "You have an additional mission for me? You can trust me totally. I'm a servant of the United States, of the OSS, and of General Donovan." "Douglas, I do indeed have a problem," Donovan admitted. They were at a corner table where they could not be overheard. "It is the extreme disobedience of General George Patton and of his very serious disregard of orders for the common cause." "Shall I kill him, sir?" Bazzata was eager to please Donovan, but also cautious. He had met Patton before and liked the general. "Yes, Douglas, you do exactly what you must. It is now totally your creation." Weeks ago, Donovan sent his personal papers relating to the Nuremberg trials back home to Washington. But it is not yet time for him to return to Europe. There is something else he must do. Between the last week of November and the middle of December, when his plane finally touches down at LaGuardia Field in New York City, while Bill Donovan will roam the European continent with no assignment or agency, he has no reason to report his whereabouts to anyone. But one thing is clear as the morning of December 9th dawns cold and damp over central Germany. While Bill Donovan and Douglas Bazzata are on a mission, and it may very well alter George Patton's future. Chapter 27, Patton's Headquarters, Bad Nauheim, Germany, December 9th, 1945, 6 a.m. The man with 12 days to live has awakened. His longtime orderly, African-American Sergeant William George Meeks, draws the bedroom curtains in George Patton's mansion on the Hollenweg Road. Morning light floods the room as the general stirs and says good morning. The weariness that rimmed his blue eyes in the last year of the war is gone. He still has the spot on his pale pink lips from smoking one too many cigars, but he's once again kicked the habit, at least temporarily. Patton has also lost weight through diet, exercise, and giving up tobacco, and looks more athletic than he has in years. He is a rejuvenated man, completely ready for whatever the future might bring. The morning wake-up is a routine that Patton and Meeks have followed throughout the war. But now that routine is soon to end. George Patton is going home to America. Official Army orders are directing him to return home, where he has arranged to take 30 days leave and celebrate Christmas with his family. After that, he plans to leave the military. Meeks will return to America with Patton, soon to settle into civilian life in Georgia. Tomorrow morning, the two men will travel by car to Paris, then on to the coast of France, where they will board a U.S. Navy battleship for the five-day Atlantic crossing. Patton has been allowed 165 pounds of luggage, which Meeks has already packed. Meeks has just finished laying out Patton's clothes for his last day in Germany, but there is soon to be a change in wardrobe. Sergeant Meeks informs Patton that last night's dinner guest, the general's close friend and commander of the 7th Army, Major General Jeffrey Keyes, has been called back to his headquarters on urgent business. Patton is disappointed. Keyes is one of his few friends remaining in Europe, and was a stalwart armored commander on whom Patton depended greatly during the Sicilian campaign. Patton has nothing to do today and was hoping for a morning of conversation with Keyes that would help allay the boredom and restlessness that has accompanied the end of the war. Patton's mansion is surrounded by a dense forest. Rattling around all day with nothing to do holds no appeal for him. So before going downstairs to his waiting breakfast, Patton orders Meeks to assemble a hunting party. There are fields 100 miles south in Mannheim, where the pheasant hunting is very good. Patton has spent an occasional Sunday there since taking command of the 15th. Meeks knows exactly what to do. "Get the limousine ready," Meeks orders. "The general and General Gay are going hunting." As the intercom once again goes silent, PFC Horace Woodring quickly rises from bed and obeys the order. The handsome, lantern-jawed Kentucky native is Patton's new driver. likes the job so much that he has just enlisted for an additional year so he can continue to drive the General. The 19-year-old son of a dairy farmer, Woodring has always had a passion for speed. He grew up racing stock cars and flying stunt planes. But if not for the fact that he suffered frostbite and was deemed incapable of remaining in the infantry, he wouldn't have been assigned to the motor pool. Twice, the crime of having relationships with local German women has seen him busted down from sergeant to private. But Patton has taken a shine to his new young driver. Woodring is the fastest, Patton marvels of the man he calls Woody. After 3 years of the overly cautious John Mims at the wheel, Patton revels in Woodring's daredevil driving. He's better than a Piper Cub to get you there ahead of time, says the General. Today will be Woodring's last day as Patton's military driver. However, Patton has hinted that he would like to hire him as his personal chauffeur after they both leave the service. The summons to go hunting is unexpected. As with most Saturday nights, Woodring was out on the town carousing the evening before. But he knew better than to overdo it just in case the General should call. Now is such a moment. Woodring will be driving Patton and his longtime chief of staff, General Hap Gay. Woodring pulls on his uniform, making sure to dress warmly for a day outside. Patton's house is across the street from where his household staff sleeps. The limousine is parked on the street due to a lack of garage space. It's a dull green 1938 Cadillac Model 75, one of four cars Patton makes use of since assuming command of the 15th. The vehicle's interior is spacious, with 6 feet of legroom between the back seat and the window partition, separating the driver's compound from the back. Woodring normally spends hours making sure that all Patton's vehicles are spotless inside and out, knowing that despite their somewhat informal relationship, Patton will have no trouble chewing him out if the car is the slightest bit unkept. The morning is exceptionally cold. Woodring waits 90 minutes before Patton steps outside with Gay. Their breaths are visible in the frigid morning air. Both men are dressed in thick military coats and gloves. Heavy boots add 2 inches to Patton's 6'2" height, making the General even more imposing than usual. With nothing else to do these past 2 months, he has spent the time traveling through Europe, riding and hunting wherever he could. Patton turned 60 just 4 weeks ago, celebrated with a lavish party thrown by his staff at Bad Nauheim's Grand Hotel. Never at a loss for words, even at this early hour, Patton walks to the sedan, jokes with Woodring, who holds the door open while the two men take their seats in the back. A Jeep driven by another of Patton's age, Sergeant Joe Scroots, pulls into line behind them. The rifles for today's hunt are loaded in Scroots' car, along with a hunting dog. Patton gives Woodring directions to the hunting ground, but first orders the driver to go to the ruins of a first-century Roman fort near Saalburg. Shortly before 9 a.m., the caravan pulls out, leaving behind the Forest Line Road. Few local Germans possess a vehicle, so there's very little traffic on the Autobahn this morning. This allows Woodring to indulge his penchant for speed. At Bad Homburg, he exits onto a side road that Patton has suggested, then carefully navigates his way up a hill to the site of the ruins. Woodring is not surprised when Patton insists on getting out of the warm car and exploring the site close up. The General's boots are not waterproof and are soon soaked as he climbs through the snow and frozen mud. Upon returning to the Cadillac after a half hour, he moves up to the front passenger seat so the car's heater can warm his sodden feet. Woodring enjoys defying authority whenever he can, so when the Cadillac comes upon a military checkpoint on the country road known as Route 38, he initially attempts to race through without stopping. The four stars on the car's license plate should tell the military policeman all they need to know. But suddenly an MP stops Patton's vehicle. "The guy must be crazy," Woodring mumbles as he gets out of the Cadillac. But Patton is only a few steps behind him. Rather than punish the sentry, who has drawn the unfortunate job of manning this lonely post on a frozen Sunday morning, Patton pats him warmly on the back. "You are a good soldier, son. I'll see to it your CO is told. What a fine MP you make." On his way back to the warmth of the front seat, Patton makes a decision that will change everything. He spies the hunting dog in the other car. "The poor thing is going to freeze to death in your goddamn truck," he yells to Sergeant Scroots, referring to the hunting dog. "Woody," Patton orders his driver, "go bring that dog inside this car. He looks cold." With the hunting dog safely in the front seat, Patton returns to the perch in the back. The journey, now in its third hour, continues. Patton's in no hurry to go hunting and relaxes as Woodring is forced to stop for a freight train. The Cadillac is at the back of a long line of U.S. military vehicles. The landscape is now far different than the wooded stretch where Patton's journey began. Bad Nauheim was untouched during the war. But now Patton sees vivid reminders of the war's destruction. Countless disabled trucks, jeeps, and tanks line the road. Just before Woodring stops for the train, Patton got a glimpse of a Polish displaced persons camp, housing thousands of people who now lack a country. He has visited many of these facilities and witnessed firsthand the filthy living conditions the residents must endure. As they wait for the long train to pass, Patton sits on the edge of his seat, as if poised to leap out of the vehicle. He peers out the window at the destruction and simply tells General Gay how awful war is. At 11:45, the crossing bar goes up as the train disappears. Woodring slowly accelerates. 600 yards in the distance, on the side of the road, two U.S. Army deuce and a half, 2.5-ton vehicles are parked on the shoulder. As Patton's limousine approaches, the trucks pull onto the highway. Behind the wheel of the first truck, Tech Sergeant Robert Thompson is a little drunk. He's a nervous man whose thick glasses give him an intellectual appearance. He wears his olive drab uniform cap at a jaunty angle. His pants are bloused into his boots, and he wears a thick Army-issue coat and gloves. Thompson has stayed up all night drinking beer with a couple of military buddies. He will later tell investigators that they spontaneously commandeered a Signal Corps deuce and a half for a few hours of joyriding through the German countryside. But in fact, there's evidence that Sergeant Thompson has stolen the truck. With the war over and the black market providing a lucrative way to make a few extra bucks, it's a very good chance that this vehicle will never be returned to Signal Corps. Stealing an Army vehicle, of course, is a strict violation of regulations. Another violation is in Thompson's two pals riding in the cab with him. Both of them apparently hung over. Army rules strictly state that only two soldiers may ride in the front seat of Army trucks. But Tech Sergeant Robert Thompson will go completely unpunished for the violations. Soon he will vanish without a trace, as will the official accident report detailing the destruction Thompson will cause. Sergeant Scruce's Jeep overtakes Patton's limousine. Scruce is the only one in the hunting party who knows the way to the special fields outside Mannheim, where Patton likes to hunt. Woodring will follow Scruce the rest of the way. Woodring is driving just 20 miles per hour. George Patton is looking out the right side of the window of the limo, while Hap Gay stares out the left. No one has time to react when Robert Thompson abruptly swerves hard to the left, driving his vehicle directly into the path of Patton's Cadillac. His motives for making the abrupt turn are unclear. There's no driveway or road in the direction he is pointing the heavy Army truck. To this day, Woodring will remember years later, I don't know where the truck was going. The sudden turn comes without warning, and both Gay and Woodring will later note that Thompson did not signal before taking the action. PFC Horace Woodring, for all his years behind the wheel, cannot avoid the collision. He slams hard on the brakes, bracing for impact, and grips the steering wheel tightly with two hands. He just turned into my car, Woodring will later tell military police, will soon evaluate the evidence and conclude that the collision was simply an accident. I saw him in time to hit my brakes, but not in time to do anything else. I was not more than 20 feet from him when he began to turn. In the truck, Sergeant Thompson makes no attempt to brake. Instead, he steps on the gas. As the truck's front bumper crashes into the Cadillac, Woodring hears the thump of flying bodies in the compartment behind him. General Gay, remembering the best way to avoid injury when falling from a horse, is to completely relax his body, so he does just that. He falls to the floor behind Woodring, uninjured. In the right back seat, George Patton is thrown forward, his head slamming violently into the steel partition between Woodring's driver's compartment and the back seat. His nose breaks. He feels a sharp pain in the back of his neck, but no sensation in his lower body. Instantly, George Patton knows he is paralyzed. Ever the leader, Patton immediately checks on his men. Is anyone hurt? After being assured Gay and Woodring are fine, Patton says in a weak voice, I believe I am paralyzed, in an upright position. Hap Gay has his right arm around him, directing Patton's head to his shoulder. Work my fingers for me, Hap, Patton commands Gay. After 5 long minutes, an MP named Lieutenant Peter K. Babalus of Boston, Massachusetts, happens on the scene. He opens the rear door to the Cadillac and is shocked to find himself staring at George Patton, still being supported in an upright seated position by General Gay. My neck hurts, Patton tells the lieutenant. A distraught Private Woodring is outside the car surveying the damage and standing guard until an ambulance arrives. Radiator fluid leaks to the ground. The car's right fender is crumpled, and the engine has been dislodged from its mount. but the rest of the Cadillac is untouched. The windshield is not even cracked. Do you realize who you hit? Woodring screams at Thompson, who has stepped down from the truck. Woodring is close enough to smell the liquor on the private's breath. This is General Patton, and he's critically injured. Thompson grins drunkenly. General Patton, he says to his companions, do you believe it? Others have now been alerted to the crash and raced to the scene. Members of the 290th Engineer Combat Battalion soon arrive with an ambulance and a doctor. Meantime, blood pours from the top of Patton's head, where a flap of skin extending from the bridge of his nose to the peak of his forehead has peeled back from his skull, as if he had been scalped. I'm having trouble breathing, Hap, Patton tells the chief of staff. Gay turns to look at Patton with his good eye. In 1922, Gay was blinded in one eye in a polo match and has fooled Army doctors about his condition ever since. Now he stares at Patton out of his left eye and studies his bleeding friend. Work my fingers for me, Patton commands Gay once more. Take and rub my arms and shoulders. Rub them hard. Gay does as he is told. At 12:43 p.m., George Patton's ambulance arrives outside the brand-new U.S. Army Hospital 130th Station. Patton has not spoken a word throughout the 25-minute ride from Mannheim. His face is growing pale. His feet are extremely cold, although he himself cannot feel them. There is no medical staff waiting to rush Patton into surgery, no crack team of spinal specialists assembled to deal with this life-threatening traumatic injury. For some reason, no one at the hospital answered the radio call from the accident site. So it is just a sleepy Sunday afternoon in Heidelberg, where the Neckar River flows slow and green past the legendary Philosopher's Walk. When the ambulance arrives, all this changes. Patton mumbles something as a young doctor leans over him. Is there anything you want, sir? The doctor asks. I don't want a damn thing, Captain, Patton tells him. I was just saying, Jesus Christ, what a nice way to start a vacation. George Patton is wheeled into an examining room, and eventually Allied authorities are given the top-secret information that one of America's great heroes is incapacitated. 2 days later, his wife Beatrice and a spinal cord specialist arrive in Germany to be at his side. Doctors believe that Strong General will survive his injuries and might be able to regain some mobility. At the very least, he should be able to travel soon. They are wrong. General Patton never leaves the hospital alive. Chapter 28, U.S. Army, 130th Station Hospital, Morgue, Heidelberg, Germany. December 21st, 1945, 7 p.m. George Patton's body is wheeled down to a makeshift morgue in the hospital basement. The room was a horse stall back in the days when this building was a German cavalry barracks. It might have made more sense simply to keep Patton in room 110, where he died. But the humiliation of his body being stored in a stall is nothing compared to the grisly spectacle that will unfold if a photograph of the dead general's body is splashed across front pages of newspapers worldwide. Hiding Patton in the basement is the best way to avoid the horde of journalists that has descended upon this tiny military hospital. Sergeant Meeks makes the concealment complete by bringing Patton's personal four-star flag to the hospital, where he shields the general's body by draping the flag over his corpse. There will be no autopsy at the demand of Beatrice Patton. The doctors quietly insist, but she will not bend on the issue. Beatrice cannot bear the thought of her beloved Georgie being carved up. Instead, she mourns him by making plans for Patton's funeral. There are many issues that need to be confronted immediately. For example, the hospital has no morticians and thus no one capable of preparing the body for burial. There are also no caskets, so one will have to be flown in from London. Finally, there is the matter of where George Patton will be laid to rest. Beatrice wants him buried at West Point, where he can be surrounded by soldiers for eternity. The Army says no. Of all the thousands of Americans who have died on foreign soil during the Second World War, not a single man has been shipped home for burial due to the cost. Vast cemeteries in Europe and Asia now hold the American dead. As distinguished as Patton might be, allowing him to be buried any place other than Europe would set a dangerous precedent. Of course, he must be buried here, Beatrice Patton says when she is informed of the policy. I know that George would want to lie beside the men of his army who have fallen. Christmas is just days away. The decision is made to bury Patton before the holiday rather than wait until afterward. He is laid to rest at the American Military Cemetery in Hamm, Luxembourg. Neither General Dwight Eisenhower nor President Harry Truman attends. One German newspaper will write eloquently about their former enemy's burial. In spite of the pouring rain, thousands line the streets from the Central Railroad Station along the tracks to the cemetery in order to render this last homage to the dead general. Hundreds of people walk from the capital to attend the burial ceremonies. Representatives of nine countries and the highest-ranking officers of the American troops stationed in Europe followed the coffin. While the gun carriage with the coffin was set on its way from the railroad station to the cemetery, a French battery fired a 17-round volley of salute. During the burial, a military band played the Third Army March. After a brief religious service, the coffin was lowered into the grave. George Patton once wrote, "I certainly think it is worth going into the army just to get the military funeral. I would like to get killed in a great victory and then have my body borne between the ranks of my defeated enemy, escorted by my own regiment, and have my spirit come down and revel in hearing what people thought of me." George Patton did not suffer the death he once longed for. But his body has been borne through the streets of a defeated Germany, and on this day, he has had his military funeral. Afterward. If you have read Killing Kennedy, you know that Martin Dugard and I are not conspiracy theorists. We write from a factual point of view with no agenda. But the death of General George Patton presents a disturbing picture if one fully accepts history's contention that his demise was simply the result of an accident. We begin with Sergeant Robert Thompson and his two friends, who were responsible for plowing into Patton's car. Shortly after the accident, Thompson claims to have been flown to England by Army intelligence for his own safety due to the number of American soldiers who worshipped Patton and would perhaps have wanted to cause Thompson physical harm. However, just 4 days after the collision, Thompson mysteriously makes his way back to Germany. There, he's interviewed by American journalist Howard K. Smith. In the wire service story Smith files on December 13th, Thompson claims that Patton's driver was speeding and at fault. Thompson also asserts that he was alone in the truck when it struck Patton's limo. But General Hap Gay and PFC Horace Woodring swear there were two other people in the truck with Thompson. Indeed, a report dated December 18, 1945, by the 7th Army Provost Marshal specifies that a German civilian employee of the 141st Signal Company of the 1st Armored Division, Thompson's company, named Frank Crummer, was in the truck at the time of the accident. The name of the other passenger was not mentioned. But that report, like every other document relating to the accident, has disappeared. So the veracity of Thompson's story was never officially challenged. His version of events was not vetted by the military police. He was not arrested or detained for anything having to do with the accident. Robert Thompson soon vanishes from the historical record, surfacing only after he dies in Camden, New Jersey, on June 5, 1994. Frank Crummer also disappears. And if there was a third occupant of the vehicle, his name remains unknown to this very day. Despite George Patton's rank and fame, the military police documenting the accident treated it as if nothing more than a fender bender. The crime scene investigation was conducted by Lieutenant Peter K. Babalus, the MP who arrived first on the scene. Military police from the 818th MP Battalion at Mannheim questioned both drivers, made notes about the damage to both vehicles, and wrote up a standard accident report. The Patton's driver testified the driver and his passengers were drunk and feeling no pain. Sergeant Thompson's blood alcohol level was never tested, and he was never charged with driving under the influence. Thompson's possession of the Signal Corps' company truck also went unquestioned, despite the fact that he was almost 60 miles north of his duty station, with no apparent reason for being in Mannheim on an otherwise quiet Sunday morning. His assertion that at the time of the accident he was turning into a quartermaster's depot to return the truck doesn't hold up, as the depot was still several hundred yards down the road. George Patton, in fact, commented about the depot when Woodring drove past it. Thompson's drunkenness, negligence, and apparent larceny went unquestioned. In fact, the first MP on the scene attempted to arrest Private Woodring, Patton's driver. It was only through the intercession of General Gay that the MP let Woodring go free. The case was then declared closed, There was no formal inquest, no attempt to speak to Patton in the hospital about his version of events, and no inquiry after his death. Sergeant Thompson's military records, which might have detailed any further actions that were taken against him, were burned on July 12, 1973, when fire swept through the National Personnel Records Center in St. Louis, Missouri, destroying 18 million official military personnel files. Incredibly, Lieutenant Babalus's report has also vanished. A 1953 request for a copy of the report by the Gary, Indiana Post-Tribune received an official response from the Army noting that first, the report of investigation is not on file, and second, Casualty Branch has no papers on file regarding the accident, and third, there is no information regarding the accident in General Gay's personnel file. Seeking more information about the death of his friend, General Jeffrey Keyes, commander of the 7th Army, immediately launched a probe of his own into the accident. But Keyes' report, too, has gone missing. In fact, the only report that remained in circulation was a curious document that was allegedly written in 1952 and signed by PFC Horace Woodring, Patton's driver. When asked about it in 1979, Woodring swore he had never made any statement or signed his name to any such report. He believed the paperwork was completely fabricated. Attempts by the authors of this book to find the official accident report were unsuccessful. If it does exist, it is very well hidden. In 1979, OSS Jedburg Douglas Bizzotta made the astounding assertion that he was part of a hit team that lay in wait for Patton's limousine. He claimed that after the crash, he fired a low-velocity projectile into the back of Patton's neck in order to snap it. When Patton did not die immediately, Bizzotta said the general was murdered in the hospital by NKVD agents using an odorless poison. Bizzotta also swore that Wild Bill Donovan paid him $10,000 plus another $800 in expenses for his role in Patton's death. But many believe that Bizzotta's story is far-fetched. No projectiles were ever found, and surely Woodring and Hap Gay would have seen any assassination team. However, Bizzotta held to his story. On September 25, 1979, he described Patton's assassination to 450 former OSS agents gathered for a reunion at the Washington Hilton Hotel. Bizzotta does have some credibility. He was heavily decorated for his service as a Jedburg, winning the Distinguished Service Cross, 4 Purple Hearts, and Francis' highest medal. After the war ended, and he left the Army in 1947 as a major, Bizzotta led a flamboyant life. He remained in France, where he studied winemaking, had a successful career as a painter, with the Duchess of Windsor and Princess Grace of Monaco, each sponsoring a showing of his work. Bizzotta himself was the subject of a painting by the eccentric artist Salvador Dali, who put the former Jedburg on canvas dressed up as Don Quixote. The British art critic Mark Weber, writing in 1969, noted that Bizzotta had lived a life eventful enough for a dozen novels. Among the former OSS members gathered in the ballroom of the Washington Hilton when Bizzotta made his claims to have killed Patton, there was much conversation. Some believed him, and even after the astounding claim, Bizzotta was hired to work for the U.S. government during the Reagan administration as a special assistant to Secretary of the Navy John F. Lehman, Jr. Upon his death in 1999 at the age of 88, Bizzotta was the subject of a lengthy obituary in the New York Times that made no mention of the claims that he'd killed Patton, which were widely known. However, in 1974, a work of fiction called The Algonquin Project by British writer Frederick Nolan was published, and it tells the story of an assassin who creeps up on Patton's vehicle immediately after the accident and shoots a low-velocity projectile into the general's neck. It has been confirmed that Bizzotta read this book. However, two former Jedburgs who knew Bizzotta well, along with journalist Joy Billington of the Washington Star, claimed that he confided to them about Patton's assassination as early as 1972, 2 years before the book was published. The strange death of George Patton should be re-examined by American military investigators. Although the trail is ice cold, technological advances could solve some of the puzzles. There is no doubt that General Patton died a hero, And history certainly honors that to this day. But the tough old general did not go out on his own terms, and there are many, many unanswered questions surrounding his death. Those questions deserve to be addressed.
Postscript. Martin Dugard's and Bill O'Reilly's research traced the main characters of this book. George Patton once stated that he wished to be buried with his men, and so he is. Many of the 5,000 interred at the American Military Cemetery just outside Luxembourg City are Third Army soldiers who fell during the Battle of the Bulge. Patton's burial site became such a popular post-war attraction that the hordes of visitors made it impossible for grass to grow around his grave or those nearby. So, on March 19, 1947, his body was exhumed and moved to the location where it now rests, in a solitary spot apart from the long rows of white crosses at the very front of the cemetery. The location suggests that Patton is still leading his men. A devastated Beatrice Patton flew home to America the day after her husband's funeral. It was Christmas. But she had given herself over to grief and mourning. There would be no holiday for her. In their 35 years together, she and George Patton endured countless separations as he waged war in Mexico, Africa, France, and Germany. In the letters he wrote during these long times away from her, she came to know his innermost thoughts and his deep love. George Patton had dyslexia, which makes spelling, reading, and writing a chore. So the very act of writing was as much a symbol of his love as the words themselves. But there would be no more letters from George Patton, as his body was lowered into the cold, wet ground of Luxembourg. Beatrice Patton's grief was almost overwhelming. Her beloved Georgie was no more. Beatrice Patton never remarried. Her grandson James Patton Totten, speaking in 2008, admitted that she hired several private detectives to look into her husband's death. Each of these investigations was unsuccessful in finding any hard evidence of an assassination. A lifelong equestrian, Beatrice suffered a ruptured aortic aneurysm while galloping across a field outside Hamilton, Massachusetts, 8 years after her husband's death. Though Mrs. Patton immediately fell from the horse, she was dead before hitting the ground. As noted earlier, she had long made it clear that she wished to be buried with her husband. When the U.S. Army refused to allow her to be interred at the American Military Cemetery in Luxembourg, her children smuggled her ashes to Europe and sprinkled them atop the grave of George Patton. The hospital where Patton died remained a U.S. Army installation until July 1, 2013. At that time, the 130th Station Hospital, or Nachrichtenkaserne, as it later became known, was closed and handed over to the German government. With the exception of a small ceremonial plaque that was hung outside the door, room 110 was not treated with any fanfare after Patton's death, and was long used as a radiology lab. In the course of researching this book, a visit was paid to the facility to see this very special room. The place where Patton died was quite ordinary. Coincidentally, this visit occurred just hours before the decommissioning, making Martin Dugard the last American visitor to enter Patton's hospital room before it was handed over to the Germans. PFC Horace Woodring, driver of Patton's Cadillac at the time of the accident, returned home to Kentucky after the war. General Dwight Eisenhower took the time to assure him personally that he had not been at fault in the auto accident that paralyzed the general. Nevertheless, Woodring was devastated by Patton's death. "I felt like a kid who had lost his father," he later remembered, "because that's how I felt about him. I had every admiration in the world for the man. I just thought he was the greatest." When Woodring's wife gave birth to a son, they gave him the middle name of Patton. Woodring and his family moved to Michigan in 1963, where he sold cars and rode snowmobiles to indulge his penchant for speed. Woodring died of heart disease in a Detroit hospital in November 2003. He was 77 years old. Until the day he died, Woodring asserted that the accident that killed Patton was inexplicable. The hero of the Battle of Fort Driant, Private Robert W. Homeland, who won the Distinguished Service Cross, was promoted posthumously to Staff Sergeant. Strangely, he has become a historical mystery. Staff Sergeant Homeland is not listed as being buried in any of the American military cemeteries in Europe, nor is he buried in Arlington National Cemetery. Captain Jack Jerry was sent home to Wisconsin for a 30-day leave after the Battle of Fort Driant. On his way back into Europe, he passed through a depot to await transportation to his unit. While there, on December 29, 1944, Jerry was killed when a captured German gun he was examining fired into his head. German generals Ernst Maisel and Wilhelm Emanuel Bergdorf, who came to Erwin Rommel's home bearing the field marshal's fatal suicide pill, lived two very different lives after that day. Maisel was promoted to lieutenant general in the waning days of the war and placed in command of the 68th Infantry Division. He was captured by American forces on May 7, 1945, released 2 years later, and lived out his days in the mountains of German Bavaria, where he died on December 16, 1978, at the age of 82. Bergdorf was long dead by then. In fact, he had committed suicide 5 days before Maisel was taken prisoner. Called to Adolf Hitler's Berlin bunker during the final days of the war, Bergdorf witnessed the Führer's signing of his last will and testament. 3 days later, Bergdorf shot himself in the head rather than be captured by Soviet troops. Just prior to Bergdorf's suicide, fellow bunker residents Joseph and Magda Goebbels chose a most grisly death. On May 1, 1945, Magda Goebbels medicated her 6 children with a drink containing morphine. She then cracked a vial of cyanide into their mouths as they slept, killing them one by one. She and her husband later went up out of the bunker, where she bit into a cyanide pill and Joseph Goebbels fired a bullet into the back of her head. Goebbels then killed himself with a pill and a simultaneous gunshot. The other elite members of the Nazi Party died in similar fashion. SS leader Heinrich Himmler, who was captured by the British 3 weeks after fleeing Berlin, killed himself in prison with a hidden cyanide pill. Hermann Göring, the corpulent head of the Luftwaffe, was arrested by American troops on May 6, 1945. On September 30, 1946, he was sentenced to be hanged by the neck until dead. But Göring, who openly laughed and joked during the Nuremberg trials, and declared that gruesome films showing Nazi concentration camp atrocities were faked, did not want to die a public death. With the unwitting help of Herbert Lee Stivers, a 19-year-old American Army guard, a cyanide ampule was smuggled into Göring's cell and he committed suicide. A local German girl who had caught Stivers' eye while he was off duty convinced him to carry medicine to Göring, hidden inside a pen. Afterward, Stivers never saw the girl again. "I guess she used me," he lamented, when Stivers finally admitted what had happened. He did so in 2005, 60 years after the fact, explaining that he was still bothered by a guilty conscience. Göring's body was put on public display in Nuremberg before being cremated. Manfred Rommel, son of Erwin Rommel, returned to his post as a Luftwaffe anti-aircraft gunner shortly after his father's forced suicide. He soon deserted and surrendered to French forces. After his release from captivity, he went to college and then entered politics, where he became mayor of Stuttgart and a leading liberal voice in post-war Germany. Magnanimous and much admired, he refused to run for national office, despite the widespread belief that he could have risen to chancellor. Rommel formed friendships with the sons of Field Marshal Bernard Law Montgomery and George S. Patton. He died on November 7, 2013, at the age of 84. General Dwight D. Eisenhower returned home a hero. He did not believe that a military officer should interest himself in politics. So, despite widespread popular support for an Eisenhower presidential candidacy in 1948, he accepted a position as head of Columbia University in New York City rather than running for office. However, he soon changed his mind. He was elected president of the United States in 1952 and 1956, serving two terms. When doctors told him that his chain smoking was a hazard to his health, Eisenhower quit the four-pack-a-day habit, cold turkey. He died of heart failure on March 28, 1969. He was 78 years old. Kay Summersby, Ike's Irish wartime consort, did not share in Eisenhower's success. She married and soon divorced, then became engaged for a short time to a man who mistakenly thought she was wealthy. After that, she wrote two tell-all books about her relationship with Eisenhower. There are unsubstantiated rumors that the two continued to meet secretly. Kay Summersby died of liver cancer in 1975 at her home in Southampton, New York. The life of Jean Gordon, Patton's wartime consort, ended on an even more tragic note. Shortly after the general's death, she and Beatrice Patton had a heated meeting in New York. The precise words that passed between them are unknown. Jean Gordon committed suicide on January 8, 1946, by gassing herself in a friend's apartment. No suicide note was entered into evidence by police. However, Patton family legend states that a message found at the scene read, "I will be with Uncle Georgie in heaven and will have him all to myself before Beatrice arrives." Omar Bradley, the general with whom Patton sparred so often during the war, went on to serve for almost 40 years in the Army, rising to the rank of five-star general and serving as Army Chief of Staff. He oversaw American forces in the Korean War and later consulted with President Lyndon Johnson during the Vietnam War. He also served as a consultant on the movie Patton, which won the actor George C. Scott an Academy Award for his portrayal of the general. Bradley lived to be 88. Ironically, Winston Churchill enjoyed an even longer life. Though overweight, a heavy drinker, and rarely seen without a cigar, Britain's wartime prime minister lived to be 90. He died on January 24, 1965, 70 years to the day after his father passed. Potsdam was the last great moment of World War II for Churchill. He flew home from Potsdam on July 25th. The next day, he learned that he'd lost the general election in a landslide to Labour Party leader Clement Attlee, who was voted in by an electorate weary of all individuals associated with the grueling war effort. The election results were a shock to Churchill's Conservative Party, who thought his wartime exploits made him a shoo-in. But polls later show that the British people believed Labour was better poised to rebuild the nation. The tables were turned in 1951 when Churchill was once again elected Prime Minister. He served from 1951 to 1955, whereupon he resigned, citing a series of strokes and his advanced age of 80. In his later life, Churchill spoke candidly about the state of the world. His funeral was the largest such state ceremony in world history until that time, with delegates from 112 nations coming to pay their respects. As his casket was borne down the Thames aboard a barge, the dock cranes lining the waterway lowered their jibs in salute. He is buried in the Churchill family plot at St. Martin's Church in Bladon, next to his wife Clementine. They were married for 56 years. Russian dictator Joseph Stalin ruled the Soviet Union for 30 years, dying at the age of 74 from a stroke and complications of heart disease brought on by years of heavy smoking. Ironically, his life might have been lengthened if doctors had reached him more quickly after his stroke, but Stalin's standing orders that his guards never enter his room worked against him. Though they thought it odd that he did not come down for breakfast or lunch on March 1, 1953, his guards refused to disobey his orders, thus delaying medical assistance. He died 4 days later. The official cause of death was a cerebral hemorrhage, but a subsequent examination of the body suggests that Stalin may have been murdered after someone slipped an odorless and tasteless rat poison named warfarin into his wine the evening before he collapsed. His body was embalmed, then placed in a mausoleum next to that of Vladimir Lenin, founder of the Soviet Union, where it was on public display in Moscow's Red Square until October 31, 1961. Stalin's remains were then removed and interred in the Kremlin Wall necropolis. Lenin's body is still on display. Soviet Marshal Georgi Zhukov, the Russian general who won the Battle of Berlin and later shared a review stand with George Patton, lived a tempestuous life after the war. Long viewed as a political threat by Joseph Stalin, he was stripped of his job as commander of Soviet ground forces in early 1946 and reassigned to a post far from Moscow in Odessa. He was recalled to Moscow in 1953, and Stalin's death 1 month later allowed Zhukov once again to become a political force. Zhukov oversaw the arrest and execution of Lavrentiy Beria, the head of the NKVD, after which he became a close advisor to the new Russian leader, Nikita Khrushchev. On his 60th birthday in 1964, Zhukov was named a Hero of the Soviet Union. He died of a stroke in 1974. His ashes are interred in the Kremlin Wall necropolis. Eleanor Roosevelt, the widow of American President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, moved to New York after her husband's death, where she lived for a time in suites at the Park Sheraton Hotel while pursuing several prominent causes. She was one of the first delegates to the United Nations, where she oversaw the passing of a document known as the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which promises basic freedoms to men and women throughout the world. Russia, quite notably, abstained from voting in its favor due to a clause known as Article 13, which asserts people's right to travel freely from one country to another. Eleanor traveled widely and gave more than 100 lectures each year. She died on November 7, 1962, from a combination of aplastic anemia and bone marrow tuberculosis. She was 78. Eleanor Roosevelt was laid to rest next to FDR at their family home in Hyde Park, New York. His time at the helm of the OSS marked the peak of Wild Bill Donovan's lifetime of adventure. He played a significant role in the birth of the Central Intelligence Agency, which was created by the National Security Act of 1947. However, President Truman was reluctant to allow him to lead the organization. Donovan returned to his law practice in New York, but once again left the law in 1953 to assume the role of U.S. ambassador to Thailand at the behest of President Dwight Eisenhower. Donovan's mental faculties soon began to slip, and he spent the last years of his life in a state of dementia. He died on February 8, 1959, at the Walter Reed Army Medical Center in Washington at the age of 76. Wild Bill Donovan is buried in Arlington National Cemetery. General George Marshall, the man who served as Army Chief of Staff during the war, died in Washington, D.C. in 1959 at the age of 78. In his lifetime, he served as General of the Army, the most senior soldier in the U.S. Army, Secretary of State, and Secretary of Defense, was Time Magazine's Man of the Year, and won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1953. His most enduring legacy was the creation of the Marshall Plan, which allowed Europe to rebuild itself after World War II with financial assistance from the United States. President Harry Truman once said that Marshall was the greatest man of his generation. Bernard Law Montgomery was named first Viscount Montgomery of Alamein after the war, a title referring to his epic defeat of Field Marshal Erwin Rommel in the Egyptian desert. Montgomery served as Britain's chief of the Imperial General Staff from 1946 to 1948, and then held a number of other military positions until his retirement from the army in 1958 at the age of 71. Outspoken as ever, he soon involved himself in a number of political issues, including supporting apartheid in South Africa, criticizing the 1967 legalization of homosexuality in Britain as a charter for buggery, and publicly ridiculing American military policy in Vietnam. Montgomery continued his habit of second-guessing his superior officers from the Second World War, particularly Eisenhower, whom he derided in his eponymous 1958 memoir. Montgomery died in 1976 at age 88. He is buried in the Holy Cross Churchyard in the southern English city of Binstead. Italian dictator Benito Mussolini preceded Adolf Hitler in death by just 2 days. Pro-communist partisans captured him and his mistress near Lake Como in the mountains of northern Italy on April 27, 1945, as the two were attempting to flee to Switzerland. They were held overnight, then driven to a remote location and killed by a firing squad. Mussolini, at his request, was shot in the chest instead of the face. The first bullet did not kill him, so a second shot was fired at point-blank range. Their bodies were then driven into the city of Milan, where they were publicly displayed hanging upside down on meat hooks. The angry citizens of Milan then spat on, kicked, and threw rocks at the corpses. Adolf Hitler learned of Mussolini's fate while in his Berlin bunker. The news gave him further incentive to have his corpse burned. Miklos Horthy Jr., the target of SS Commando Otto Skorzeny's Operation Mickey Mouse, spent the remainder of World War II as a German prisoner in the Dachau concentration camp. He was freed by Allied forces on May 5, 1945. Due to the Russian invasion of his Hungarian homeland, he spent the rest of his life in exile in Portugal with his father Miklos Horthy, the longtime Hungarian regent. Otto Skorzeny was acquitted of war crimes at the 1947 Dachau trials. While he was being held to determine if further charges could be filed, 3 former SS officers dressed as American MPs successfully helped him escape. For a time, he devoted himself to helping other former SS members escape from Germany. Skorzeny later worked with espionage agencies around the world in a number of clandestine activities. Ironically, among them was Mossad, the intelligence agency for the Jewish state of Israel. Skorzeny died of cancer in July 1975 at the age of 67. Major Hal McCown, who was the prisoner of Joachim Pieper at Le Glaize, remained in the army until 1972. He went on to serve in Korea and Vietnam and retired as a major general. McCown died in 1999. He is among a number of American junior officers during the Second World War who went on to lead the military during the Vietnam War years. Another was Lieutenant Colonel Creighton Abe Abrams, who had a long and successful military career. He became a 4-star general and chief of staff of the Army during the Vietnam War. All 3 of his sons became general officers, and his 3 daughters all married military men. Abrams' lifelong fondness for cigars finally caught up with him in the 1970s, and he died of complications of lung cancer in 1974. He is buried in Arlington National Cemetery next to his wife of 38 years, Julia. Other key Bastogne figures went on to long and successful Army careers and formed the backbone of the officer corps during the Vietnam War. Lieutenant Colonel Harry Kennard, who suggested that General Tony McAuliffe formally reply nuts to the German surrender order, commanded the 1st Air Cavalry Division in Vietnam, which fought in the legendary Battle of Ia Drang. This was immortalized in the book We Were Soldiers Once and Young, and the movie by the same name. Kennard lived until 2009 when he passed away at the age of 93. Major William de Sobry, who so famously held the line in Noville, remained a German prisoner of war until the spring of 1945. He later rose to lieutenant general and stayed in the army until 1975. He passed away in 1996. A street in Noville now bears his name. The Rue du Général de Sobry is a pivotal crossroads on the way into Bastogne. General Anthony McAuliffe, the hero of Bastogne, would never shake his connection with the Nuts response, which has gone down in history as one of warfare's great quotations. His military career continued until 1956, when he left the service and went on to a number of high-ranking civilian occupations. He died in 1975 at the age of 77. Before dying, he recounted his weariness about his claim to fame. "One evening, a dear old Southern lady invited me to dinner. I had a delightful time talking to her and her charming guests. I was pleased because no mention was made the entire evening of the Nuts incident. As I prepared to depart and thanked my hostess for an enjoyable evening, she replied, 'Thank you and good night, General McNutt.'" George Patton's oldest daughter, Beatrice, remained married to John Waters until her death on October 24, 1952. She gave birth to two sons, John and George Patton. Her sister, Ruth Ellen, married a career Army officer, James Totten, who rose through the ranks to become a major general. They had two sons, Michael and James, both of whom continued the family lineage of service in the Army. In her memoir, The Button Box, A Daughter's Loving Memoir of Mrs. George S. Patton, Ruth Ellen wrote that at the moment of her father's death, she woke up and saw him standing at the foot of her bed in full uniform. "I sat up in bed. I could see him plainly. When he saw I was looking at him, he gave me the sweetest smile I've ever seen." In the morning, she called her sister Beatrice, who reported a similar occurrence. She said she had been fast asleep when the phone by her bed rang. She picked it up, and there was a lot of static, as if it were an overseas call. And she heard Georgie's voice ask, "Little B, are you all right?" But when young Beatrice Patton called the overseas operator, she was told that there had been no call. General George Patton's only son, George Patton IV, got the news at West Point, where he was midway through his senior year. His father was buried on his 22nd birthday. George Jr. was unable to leave West Point for the funeral. After his commissioning, he followed in his father's footsteps and rose to the rank of Major General. He served in the Korean War and also did several tours in the Vietnam War. Like his father, he spoke fluent French and was passionate about history. During his lifetime, Patton legally changed his name to avoid any confusion between him and his father, who had gone by George S. Patton, Jr., even though his actual name was George S. Patton III. The younger Patton dropped the Roman numeral IV so that he was simply George Patton. He died in 2004 at the age of 80. General Patton and his wife, Joanne, had five children. Among them, their oldest son, George Patton V.
This is Bill O'Reilly. We hope you've enjoyed this production of Killing Patton. Killing Patton was directed by Laura Wilson and Scott Sherratt. Executive producer, Laura Wilson. Text copyright 2014 by Bill O'Reilly and Martin Dugar. Production copyright 2014 by Macmillan Audio. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.
Chapter 3, Trianon Palace Hotel, Versailles, France, October 21st, 1952. 1944, early afternoon. Just as Hitler is briefing Skorzeny, General Dwight D. Eisenhower lights a cigarette in his first-floor office. His headquarters, a white stone French chateau 1,000 miles west of the Wolf's Lair, is spotless and regal. The only challenge Eisenhower should be facing right now is how best to celebrate a major turning point in the war.